Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. That old adage that if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all, doesn't tend to apply on the internet, where harassment is booming. A new report from the Pew Research Center reveals that more than 4 of every 10 Americans have experienced some form of online harassment. Joining us now is the author of that report, research associate at the Pew Research Center, Maeve Duggan. Welcome back, Maeve.
Thanks for having me.
You've been looking at this issue for a few years now. Has there been a big change over time?
So the first study that we did on this topic was back in 2014. And at that point in time, 35% of Americans had experienced any form of online harassment. As you just mentioned, today in 2017, that number is up to 41%. So we've seen a modest increase.
How are we defining harassment for the purposes of your studies?
We used 6 different behaviors to measure harassment, and this includes more mild forms like name calling and purposeful embarrassment, and also some more severe behaviors like physical threats, sexual harassment, stalking, or harassment over a sustained period of time.
And was there any uptick in particular noticeable among those different types?
So we saw a small change in the percentage of adults who have been called an offensive name online. But really, the differences that we've seen are less in the types of behaviors and more in who's been getting harassed. So, for example, young people, as in 2014, are still the most likely demographic group to have experienced any form of online harassment. 2/3 of adults ages 18 to 29 have received some form of abuse. And this also includes 41% who have received a severe type of online harassment. But where we see the biggest change is actually among older adults. Those ages 30 to 49 saw a 10-point uptick, and those 50 and older saw a 5-point increase.
Any sense that that's just attributable to the fact that more people in those age groups are online?
Sure. In some of our other work, we track the percentage of Americans who are internet users or who own a cell phone or a smartphone. And young people are typically early adopters. And we do see kind of a tail end of older people who then adopt these types of technologies. And currently, especially with smartphones, it's about 3/4 of Americans now on a smartphone.
You know, but I would have thought, you know, with the adoption, you know, age of adoption aside, young people tend to just pick on each other more than older people do, or at least I thought so until I started reading comment sections in online media.
Yes, we certainly found that online harassment is a pretty pressing issue for all types of people, whether it's their age, their race, their gender. So in some ways, harassment doesn't discriminate.
Does it make a difference when there's anonymity involved?
Yes. So this is a really interesting topic and one that we decided to explore more after we received some open-ended comments in our 2014 survey that really pegged harassment to anonymity. We had a lot of respondents who mentioned that in their comments. So this time around, we asked about anonymity in a couple of different ways. And I think the most striking figure is that 89% of Americans agree that the ability to be anonymous online enables cruel or harassing behavior. And in practice, what this looks like is when we ask those who have actually been harassed who was behind their harassment, half of those people said that it was either a stranger or somebody whose real identity they didn't know.
How do people feel about it? Did you ask them that?
We asked about that in a couple of different ways. Probably the broadest way that we asked about it was whether people consider online harassment a major problem. And 62% of Americans agree that online harassment is a major problem. What they're more divided on is the underlying issues that enable or create the environment in which harassment occurs.
So things like anonymity and then, of course, the platforms that and whether or not they're getting involved.
Right. So we asked about the balance between free speech, for instance, versus safety online. And Americans are pretty divided on that account. So 53% feel that it's more important for people to feel welcome and safe, whereas 45% think it's more important that people be able to speak their minds freely online. Another way that we looked at this is kind of the quote-unquote political correctness angle, whether people feel offensive content is taken too seriously or dismissed too easily. And again, we see a pretty even split, with 56% of adults saying that offensive content online is taken too seriously, while 43% say that it's excused too often is not a big deal.
Did you see much difference in among the age groups on that score?
The real interesting demographic differences here are among men and women. So we see that men are more likely to say that offensive content is taken too seriously. About two-thirds of men say that, whereas half of women say that this type of content isn't taken seriously enough. Women also tend to prioritize safe spaces online, whereas men tend to favor free speech.
Did you get into the – I mean, I wonder how much that has to do with sex harassment online.
So we did ask about sexual harassment and other forms of sexualized abuse online. Mm-hmm. And women are certainly more likely to take the brunt of that, especially among young women. One striking figure is we found that 53% of women ages 18 to 29 have received an explicit image that they didn't ask for.
That just grosses me out to hear you say that. Who do people think is responsible? I guess, first of all, there's the value of civility, and you're saying that people are pretty split about whether or not that's something that should be somebody's responsibility, that just ignore it, go away. It can't hurt you if you ignore it.
Yeah. So what's interesting is that most people do actually ignore their harassment. When we ask people how they responded, most people say, I ignored it, and they were pretty satisfied with that approach. The other portion of people have taken some sort of step in response, whether that's kind of an easy digital step, like reporting somebody to a website, flagging content as, you know, inappropriate, or blocking somebody, unfriending somebody, things like that. For people who know the other person on the other end of the computer harassing them, they will do things like actually confront the person face-to-face or on a phone call or on a text message. So there are a lot of different ways that people go about this. But the most common response is just to ignore it.
And that's among young people? That's typical?
Among the entire population that's been harassed, most people will just ignore it.
Did you ask people if they were guilty of dishing out harassment online?
I wish that we could have. It's a hard question to ask because of this thing called social desirability, where in surveys, you know, there's this element that you want to present yourself as, you know, an upstanding member of society, if you will. So it's a little tough to trust that we would get an honest answer on that. So we weren't able to ask that particular question. So maybe we'll figure out a way to do it in another survey.
Well, I'm always wondering if people actually self-identify properly, sometimes don't see what they're doing as harassment.
Well, it's interesting that you bring that up, because one theme of this report is that harassment can be pretty subjective. So we asked people a series of questions about their experiences. And at the very end of it, we asked them, do you consider what happened to you to be online harassment? So essentially, would people label it with those words themselves? Mm-hmm. And we get kind of a split response. 36% of people say, yes, it was online harassment. 37% say, no, it wasn't. And 27% were just unsure. They said they didn't know. But where this question gets really interesting is we ask, when you look at the cross tab of those who have had severe experiences versus those whose harassment has been limited to these more mild forms I mentioned, like name calling or embarrassment, mm-hmm. We see that 28% of those who have had what we categorize as severe experiences said that they actually didn't consider what happened to them online harassment. And on the other end of that, 32% of those who just had these more mild forms agreed that, yeah, they actually did call it harassment. So in some ways, harassment is kind of in the eye of the beholder.
And again, you might have already answered this, but just to be clear, younger people seem less concerned, or you're saying that these numbers held up across the board? It didn't matter.
These are among the whole population of those who have been harassed, regardless of age.
And again, when you said that men seem to think that there's a gender difference and that men seem to think people take this stuff more seriously than women do, there is no way to suss out whether or not, well, that's because they're the ones dishing it out.
Right. But we weren't able to say among people who have done harassment, they feel this way or not. But there are some age splits in terms of gender. So we see that young men in particular are likely to favor free speech. So we were able to kind of break down some demographics in that way. But unfortunately, we don't have a data point on people self admitting that they were the ones doing the harassing.
And to what extent did you see much of a difference in age or gender when it came to what extent people think that online platforms are responsible for monitoring and policing this issue?
Yeah, so overall, we see that American adults, regardless of age, really do hold companies responsible. So we found that 79% of adults say that online companies should be responsible for the harassment that occurs on their platforms. We also asked this question in a slightly different way. Which entities people think should play a major role in addressing this issue, whether that's online companies, elected officials, bystanders, so other people online who are witnessing this behavior. And once again, we see that people really put a big onus on companies to address this issue head on.
Maeve Duggan, thanks so much for joining us again. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for talking about this topic.
Maeve Duggan, a research associate at the Pew Research Center's Internet Project. We'll have a link to that study on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. More Tech Tuesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Every day, more than 40 billion texts are sent using a total of 6 billion emojis. So emojis are a thing. And now they have their own movie, which opens in theaters across the country. The story imagines a world where the cartoon symbols on your phone have lives of their own and sometimes feel boxed in by expressing just one emotion.
My name is Gene. I'm a meh. So I gotta be totally over it all the time, you know, like, meh, who cares? Which is not as easy as it sounds.
I gotta be meh. I gotta be meh.
Some deride emojis as a crude form of communication, but others believe they add nuance and emotion to texts. Joining us now by phone is cognitive linguist and author of the new book, The Emoji Code, The Linguistics Behind Smiley Faces and Scaredy Cats, Vivian Evans. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
You favor emojis. You think that they're helpful. How so?
Okay. So the best way of thinking about emojis is to think about the default form of communication, because people often think that, you know, an emoji is the equivalent to an adolescent grunt, taking us back to the dark ages of illiteracy. But in our everyday social lives, when we communicate with one another in face-to-face spoken exchanges, we know that between 60 and 70% of emotional expression comes not in fact from language, but from nonverbal cues. And what I mean by nonverbal cue is things like facial expressions. Humans can produce in excess of 10,000 distinct facial expressions using 43 facial muscles that relate to a whole slew of different emotional reflexes. I also mean gestures, eye gaze, which is very important, body language and posture. So all of this information provides important nuancing in terms of how we're feeling about things. Imagine also tone of voice, how it would be possible, or that the impossibility, in fact, of communicating things like irony without tone of voice to tell your addressee that the meaning of the words is opposite to what they're literally saying. Now, by analogy, that stuff is missing. That emotional expression is missing in digital communication. On average, we spend around 27 hours a week using digital communication to communicate with our nearest and dearest. So in the absence of effective emotional expression in text, in digital communication, emoji puts the nonverbal body language back into emotional expression and makes us better communicators in the process.
It does, but when we're just communicating face-to-face, are we as conscious of it as when we're using an emoji? And does that matter?
When we're communicating face-to-face, I don't think people are aware that a lot of emotional expression and personality, you know, that sort of telling people how we're unique in different ways, that we're aware of it. But body language, facial expression, and so on really provide powerful cues, and they drive our ability to put ourselves in one another's shoes, which is known as empathy. And it's empathy that drives successful communication. And in fact, all this stuff, this nonverbal stuff, in fact, changes the meaning of words. So let me just give you a quick example. If we take a sort of a standard hackneyed expression like I love you, and you say it with a falling pitch contour, so you say it as if it's a statement, I love you, that becomes presumably a declaration of undying love. But if you change it and you have it with rising pitch, so as if it's a question, I love you, that becomes an ironic counterblast that can really put someone down. So the point here is that something as simple as intonation, how you say the words, in fact changes the meanings of the words. And it's that kind of intonation that is part of a key nonverbal cue that can impact on language. And we're just not aware of it when we communicate with one another, but it's very important.
Do emojis constitute a form of language?
Not strictly speaking, and not in the way that people actually use emojis in their daily digital lives. So what makes something a language is basically two things. First, it has to have a sophisticated vocabulary so that you have a range of vocabulary items to provide sort of a rich inflected meaning. So we know from research that by adolescence, English speaking kids have a vocabulary of around 12,000 words. Now, in comparison, as of June 2017, there are around 2,500 emojis. So in terms of a rich semantic range of things that we can express, emoji clearly falls far short. But the hallmark of a language is that it has a grammar. So this is the system of rules that joins words up. And emoji just doesn't have this. Now, that doesn't mean that in principle, emoji couldn't become a language. So there's a London-based visual designer that has translated, of all things, Alice in Wonderland into emoji. Mm-hmm. So Alice in Wonderland is a kid's story, very famous 19th century story by Lewis Carroll, of course, that's 27,500 words. And this guy, Joe Hale from London, translated Alice in Wonderland using 25,000 emojis. And what he did was he imbued emoji with a grammar. But of course, to understand, to you know, visually scan this thing and try and read, as it were, the emoji language of Alice in Wonderland, you actually have to learn this as if it's a new language. And most people don't use emojis in that kind of way. They use them to nuance, complement, and tweak the meanings of SMSs, their text speak, and so on, when they communicate with their nearest and dearest.
Are they comparable to, say, like hieroglyphics?
Not really. So hieroglyphs were a very early form of writing. And writing, any writing system, like hieroglyphs, they were invented around 3,500 BCE. That was a writing system, essentially, its function is to represent a spoken language. The hieroglyphs were developed primarily to represent ancient Egyptian. So in that sense, emoji is not a writing system. It sort of forms, it for in the digital age, it functions as a form of body language to nuance the meaning of our text messages. So it's quite different from writing. But from another perspective, there is a similarity. So hieroglyphs originated from ancient artistic traditions that were prevalent at that period in Egypt. And they were based on pictograms. And in that sense, there is a similarity because, of course, one of the motivations of emojis is that they have to be pictographic. And that is enshrined in the body that oversees emojis today. So new emojis that see the light of day have to be visual metaphors often. They have to be firmly pictographic. They can't be writing-based.
When we're talking about that 2,500 emojis that are out there that are certified emojis, I guess, out there right now, are you talking about just the facial expression ones or, you know, the bicycle and the apple and the, you know, all the different kinds of, you know, the flags and all that kind of thing?
Yeah. So there are around 1,400 single character emojis, and then there are emoji sequences. So you can have the pop singer emoji, which is made up of several emojis that combine together, including skin tone modifiers. Mm-hmm. That you can vary. If you want to have a selfie emoji, for example, there is such a thing as a selfie emoji. So what you have, if you send a selfie emoji, is the hand with the smartphone being held up, and you can modify the color of the skin tone of the arm, different colors and so on. So there are several emojis to create something like that. There are several emojis that have to be combined together. There's a kind of hidden virtual glue that brings these things together. So several individual emojis work together to produce this complex or compound emoji with the arm and the smartphone and the different colored skin. So all together, there's around 2,500, a little over.
Are emojis bad for literacy? Any thoughts about that?
Okay, so this is a question that I'm often asked. Are emojis bad for literacy? And the answer is no. First of all, they're not a writing system. One way of thinking about this is the debate that happened in the early 2000s when internet slang became prevalent. So things like OMG, LOL, and so on. And people started saying, commentators in the popular media started saying, you know, this is, again, going to be bad for literacy rates because kids in particular will lose the ability to spell. But in fact, when the research was done, what researchers found was that to actually be able to use these abbreviations, you actually need to know how to spell to figure out what the abbreviations mean. So, which is pretty cool if you think about it. And one of the points that I make in the book, the emoji code that you referenced at the top of this segment, is that emoji makes us more effective communicators in the digital age. They allow us to communicate more effectively emotional resonance, which makes people get us more. It's more effective, for example, we know from research in terms of dating. The more emojis you send, the more effective you are at getting dates. And it's not that, you know, you send more emojis and therefore you get to go on more dates. If only, there's not a direct correlation. It's not a cause-effect situation, unfortunately. But what the point here, and there is a serious point, is that when you send emojis, people understand what you're trying to convey more effectively. It's as if, you know, if you go back to the situation with the face-to-face spoken interaction, imagine someone talking but without making any facial expressions, just being completely deadpan, without modulating their intonation. So they speak with a complete low monotone and there's no inflection whatsoever. They sound like a robot. This is a person you wouldn't want to hang out with at all. But if you start using expression, if you start using facial expressions, if you smile and wink, you become much more personable. And you increase what I call empathetic resonance. Empathy is increased. You're able to put yourself in the other person's shoes. And that's what using emoji does in text speak. It makes us more effective in terms of communication. Far from dragging us back to illiteracy, in fact, it's a step forward in the digital age.
Do you get into etiquette at all in your book?
I beg your pardon, etiquette?
Yeah.
There's a little bit about etiquette, and one of the things that we know is that people, the advice is, this is top tip, you shouldn't rush into an emoji relationship. In the same way that, you know, if you start leering at people, that's a stranger in the street that you haven't met, and smiling and making these odd kind of ducking expressions and so on, someone would think you've just turned out, you know, you've been turned out of the local asylum. And in the same way, the same holds true of emojis. You need to establish rapport before it's permissible to start using a lot of emojis.
Say, particularly in business and that kind of a thing.
Yeah, so this is one of the things that people often ask me, is it appropriate to use emojis in professional and business in particular contexts? And one of the difficulties, of course, is that emojis do look cartoon-like.
Mm-hmm.
They originated, of course, in the late 1990s in Japan. They come from the manga cartoon, or in part, at least, they come from the manga cartoon tradition, which, in fact, goes back in Japanese culture to the 19th century. So they are cartoon-like, and for a lot of people, they do look fairly puerile and adolescent and so on. And that is potentially a drawback. But I think as we become more adept at using them, they will evolve, and there will be certainly some of the work I've been doing in the UK, for example, with software developers and app developers, has been to develop more professional-looking bespoke emojis, because we do know from research, some of the research that I've done for businesses in London, for instance, is that people have a need for using and have expressing the need, in fact, and saying that professional contexts are becoming less formal than a couple of decades earlier, and there is more of a requirement, particularly as people transact interaction more and more through the digital medium, to use and to have recourse to things like emojis. And I think some of our politicians, perhaps, world leaders, could learn a thing or two. I think there'd be fewer wars and conflicts if people could get each other better and use political emojis, perhaps.
Hmm. How do you rate the range of emojis out there right now? New emojis are always coming out. Are there any emotions or feelings that you're rooting for out there in the emoji world?
Well, what we know is that in terms of, you mentioned 6 billion or so in a sent on a daily basis,
yeah,
by the world's internet users, there are 3.2 billion internet users in the world, and around 92% of that in, hooked up virtual population regularly use emojis. One thing that we know is around 70% of the global emoji usage relates directly to emotional expression, primarily positive expression. So around 45% of the 70% that relates to, 45% of the total 70% is relates to emotion, 45% of our total emoji usage relates to positive emotions, so things like smiley faces, winks, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So the rest doesn't get much of a look in the flags, the animals. There are some interesting ones that get co-opted because of visual metaphors in romantically themed texts, also known as sexting, which is quite curious and interesting. But primarily, emoji usage relates to emotions. That's how it's primarily used. And given that, I mean, there are 100-plus different faces that relate to primary emotions. So primary emotions are emotions that are universal. Then there are secondary and also tertiary emotions that are perhaps culture-specific. But in a sense, in an important sense, it doesn't matter whether you're a speaker, a native speaker of English, Swahili even, French, Japanese, we're all speaking, or nearly all speaking, emoji now. A smiley means the same thing in any language. So I think this is a powerful form of global communication.
Emojis can look different on different devices and messaging apps. Is that a problem? Would you like to see more uniformity?
This can be a problem. There's two things here, I think. One is that, the first thing to observe is that emojis are not copyrighted. So they're established by a California-based consortium known as Unicode. Unicode was established in 1988. It's made up of the big tech companies. 8 of the 11 permanent members are North American. And this consortium sets the international standard in terms of, in broad terms, what emojis are supposed to look like. But then individual providers, Android providers or Apple and so on, have their own ecosystems and they look slightly different across devices. Now, what happens is, if you take, for example, the grinning face emoji, this is a notorious one. Mm-hmm. These can look quite different across the different devices. And this can, in fact, be a problem. And different, the same emoji can evoke a different sentiment and have a different, what's known as a different sentiment ranking across devices. So something, a grinning face, can look very positive if you're a Samsung user, but it can look slightly scary and negative if you're an Apple user, or at least it did before they changed it in the last update. And this can be a problem. But one way of thinking about this is that, in fact, emoji has different dialects depending upon which kind of platform individual users are, in fact, using. So that's one issue. The second issue is that for purposes of perhaps PR, and because also these companies, the software providers that devise their own bespoke-looking emojis have shareholders, is that some of these companies can change the look of individual emojis. A good example, of course, is the handgun emoji, which Apple recently changed to resemble a water pistol, so a harmless child's toy. And this, of course, is kind of sensitive and an emotive issue, because if you use an Android device, you send a handgun emoji to someone, it looks like a revolver or a pistol. But when you receive it on your Apple smartphone, it looks like a water pistol.
Hmm.
That means something quite different across devices. There's, of course, a rationale for this from Apple's perspective, and this relates to a spate of instances where people got themselves into trouble and things were perceived as death threats or alleged. There was a case in the US with an alleged terroristic threat with the handgun emojis sent facing a police officer, an emoji, and the particular individual was an arrest warrant by the New York District Attorney was issued. So this can, of course, be a sensitive issue.
Do you have some favorite emojis, or are you kind of like everybody else? You use, the common ones that express the common emotions.
Well, there are two ways of answering this. I'm of course, like everyone in the sense that I use the most popular ones. The face with tears of joy is a particular, it's quite ubiquitous. That was dubbed controversially for some as the word of the year in 2015 by Oxford Dictionaries, which is the world's leading arbiter of English language usage. My actual favourite is the dancing lady in the red dress. I just think it's inherently sexy and great fun. You just can't use it, though. It's just almost impossible to use. But I just think it's a great emoji.
Do you ever try to think of ways to use it?
Well, I sent it to my wife. I kept getting interviewed, and people were saying, "What's your favourite emoji?" And I was on a live BBC show last week, and they said, "What's your favourite emoji?" I said, the dancing lady in the red dress, and then my wife said to me, "Well, who do you use that with?" So I immediately then texted her with it. So I have now used it.
The dancing lady in the red dress. I have it up right now.
Yeah, flirtatious purposes.
Yeah. All right. Well, Vivian Evans, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Vivian Evans is a cognitive linguist and author of the book, The Emoji Code, The Linguistics Behind Smiley Faces and Scaredy Cats. More Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Thank you. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's been just over a year since the augmented reality game Pokemon Go came out. The game made a huge splash, remains very popular, and a topic of conversation on Tech Tuesday. Over the weekend, the makers of the game held a festival that attracted thousands of players to Chicago. Unfortunately, problems with data service turned the event into a flop. Joining us now to talk about that and other tech news is contributing editor at Android Central, Russell Holly. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So you didn't go to the Pokemon Go Fest, right?
I didn't, but my boss did.
Oh, and what was it supposed to do?
Well, so the whole goal was to be, you know, the 1 year celebration of this game, and it was a kind of a big challenge where they had 20,000 people in Grant Park in Chicago, and they all had to kind of work together to reach a certain number of goals in the game, you know, and if the people there at the event were able to reach those goals, then they would be rewarded, you know, that day with you know, kind of special things. And then those rewards would be extended to the entire rest of the world the next day. But they would have, for that first day, they would have, you know, kind of the first access to those rewards. And so they had, 20,000 people in the park and more within kind of a 2 mile radius of Grant Park, all playing the game for a good 18 hours.
I'm trying to visualize how big Grant Park is and if it can hold 20,000 people at once like that.
So Grant Park has been the home to a big concert festival called Lollapalooza in the past, and that occupies significantly more of Grant Park. This was probably a quarter the size of what Lollapalooza would normally be. So Grant Park is a very big park. It's definitely enough to hold this, but that's still a tremendous number of people all using their phones at the same time in the same place.
And that was the problem, right?
That was definitely the problem, you know, because this this space has been kind of renovated in the past to make sure that there is enough cellular signal and you know, kind of quality of service there from Verizon and AT&T and T-Mobile and Sprint to handle this big concert series. There was kind of an assumption that what was there was already enough for the people who were going. But apparently playing this game uses a little more, bandwidth than maybe posting a picture on Twitter or something as you're at a concert. And so it really didn't take very long once there were 20,000 people there, you know, for the mobile networks to start to really struggle. And the game would be, you know, kind of unplayable for a while. And then the Niantic servers themselves started to struggle. There are video clips of just this sea of people all kind of chanting in unison, "We can't play, we can't play." And it's really kind of amazing to see this many people, you know, kind of all not necessarily outraged, but clearly irritated that they came all this way to play the game and weren't able to for a little while, close to 2 hours in some cases.
I would imagine there's families and that kind of thing all there together, right?
Yeah, there was, you know, really just kind of every type of human being. There were, you know, kids and adults. And, you know, that's kind of been one of the really cool things about this game over the last year is that there is not one type of person playing the game. It really is just kind of a collection of humanity. And it's been really entertaining to see that and, you know, kind of meet new people as you go out. And, you know, so they did eventually, you know, fix everything and get the game back up and running. And the people who were there were able to unlock all of the goals that they had at the end of the game during that event. And as a result, there was this big unlock of the special kind of Pokemon that could be captured throughout the world. And it restarted, you know, kind of the original videos from the first week that Pokemon was out, where there were just, you know, hundreds of people kind of roaming through parks and stuff all over the world. That restarted this past weekend, you know, where there were, you know, just more just huge groups of people coming out and playing these games in places that you really hadn't seen since the first couple of months.
So it was just a temporary fail then. Russell Holly? It looks like we've lost Russell Holly. We'll get him right back. We've been talking about the Pokemon Go Fest in Chicago. It was a temporary fail. But it seems like it turned out okay. Russell's pretty high on it still. I wanted to just talk to him about whether he was surprised that 20,000 people showed up. What do you think? Are you playing Pokemon Go out there? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. It's Save the All Sides host time. If you want to call and talk to me about Pokemon Go or just about anything, you can right now, 614-292-8513. Or email us at allsides@wosu.org because we're still working. Russell, are you there?
I am.
All right. Welcome back. Way to leave me hanging out there. I felt like I was at a Pokemon Go convention. So they got it all back up. People weren't ticked. What do you think about going forward? What's the future of Pokemon Go?
Well, I think one of the big things that we saw from this weekend was really just kind of a resurge of, you know, kind of the original response to this game where there were just hundreds of people out in the wild all playing the game together. It was really kind of fascinating to see all over the world more huge groups of people coming out and playing because of the goals that had been earned at this festival. You know, here in Maryland, when we went out, there were, you know, there were caravans of vehicles driving from place to place to play the game in all of the different venues, and people walking all around with their phones out, very much like there was a year ago. Really hadn't seen this many people playing the game out in the wild for a couple of months.
Would you?
So it was really interesting to see that come back.
Would you go to one of those Pokemon festivals?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think it would be a ton of fun to do something like that, and it's something that, you know, I kept playing with my kids, you know, to a point where even my my oldest daughter, you know, her account is very much, you know, one of the more capable accounts when it comes to, you know, fighting these creatures and you know, playing the game. So it ends up being a lot of fun to do, not just by myself, but, you know, with my kids.
Right. Samsung's newest phone, the Galaxy Note 8, it's coming out next month. It's much anticipated after the recall of the exploding Galaxy Note 7 last year. Remind us, you know, what those notes, you don't see them in the airports anymore, but they were warning people, if you have one of these phones, just don't bother bringing it on the plane.
Oh, yeah, it was really bad for a while where, you know, you couldn't get on a plane or a train or a bus without some kind of warning about the Galaxy Note 7. And the phone remained popular even after those recalls of people who, you know, refused to hand their phones in. And it was so much so that Samsung ended up re-releasing the Galaxy Note 7 as what they called a fan edition, where they had fixed the battery problem, you know, kind of recently, actually, within the last month or two, so that you know, this phone could continue to, you know, to sell with these kind of refurbished models. But we have the actual successor to the Galaxy Note 7, which is the Galaxy Note 8, coming at the end of August. And, you know, this is Samsung, you know, earned a lot of their, you know, kind of credit back with the smaller Galaxy S7 earlier this year. It ended up being tremendously popular and none of them blew up, which is always a positive. So, you know, this is, you know, kind of a continuation of that line. And the thing that separates the Galaxy Note phones from the Galaxy S phones, as confusing as it would be for someone who doesn't actually care about smartphones, is that these are the bigger phones with a stylus baked in. They're designed to offer, you know, a little more in the way of features, a battery that'll last, you know, a little more than just a single day. They're designed for people who are just constantly obsessed with using their phone for more than, you know, just playing the occasional game and checking things on Facebook.
Just all things being equal, how do you rate Samsung and its response to this, what might some companies might see as a real crisis?
I think Samsung stumbled initially with this. You know, they tried really hard to downplay it and say that it was a, you know, kind of a small thing. And then by the time they did, you know, the full recall, I think there was a fair bit of mixed information out there. You know, that there were YouTube videos within the first week, you know, kind of downplaying this as a hoax. You know, these tech personalities. Because of things that had been heard from Samsung. So I think, you know, within the first week, there were a lot of communications problems from Samsung. After that first week, I think they did a good job replacing the phone as quickly as possible for a lot of their users and making it very, very clear when they launched the Galaxy S8 that these kind of problems aren't going to happen again.
I got to give them credit for having a loyal fan base, right?
It was, you know, it was really fascinating. I knew that there were loyal Samsung fans out there, but to see, you know, like there is a video of someone's Jeep that had, you know, basically burned down. You know, the Jeep was charred from the inside out. And these people were still saying, no, I'm not going to turn my phone in. I mean, at some point, there's kind of a limit.
Man, I tell you. So the Galaxy Note 8, besides not blowing up, anything interesting about it that you're expecting?
Samsung is going to keep pushing the two things that make the Galaxy Note really special. The first is, you know, having a battery that just is, you know, can't be beat by the other phones that are out there. And the other thing is this stylus. You know, there are people who buy a Galaxy Note phone. They really love the, you know, having this extra pen that gives them the ability to do things like take notes and draw directly on web pages, you know, to, you know, kind of send things. It gets billed often as kind of a work phone because you can do a little more on it. I'm not sure that that's entirely true. I think it just allows you to have a different kind of play and ends up being, you know, just a luxury for people who really like having the thing that is considered the best.
Another highly anticipated device is the new gaming console from Microsoft, the Xbox One X. What do we know about the new features for the Xbox One X? What can gamers expect?
The big thing that Microsoft has been pushing for the Xbox One X is 4K. This is going to be the console that does everything in 4K for 4K televisions. It's going to have, you know, gaming in 4K. It's going to be able to stream movies and play Blu-ray and do everything in the highest, you know, possible quality video. So if you have a 4K television, the bottom line is that this is going to be the game console that you want. There's still kind of a problem there in that, you know, 4K is not the dominant kind of television that is in everyone's houses right now. It is certainly growing at a pretty healthy rate, but it's, you know, we don't have 4K coming in from our cable providers yet. So a lot of people don't really feel compelled to upgrade at the rate that we did from, you know, standard definition to high definition.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, it's kind of complicated, but for gamers, you know, for people who have, you know, kind of that high quality entertainment center and they really want kind of the best picture and the best gaming experience, that's what Microsoft is selling here, is that this is going to be, you know, kind of the best way to play your games.
How about game makers? How are they tapping into this?
Game makers have been approaching this from two different perspectives, and one is kind of a really interesting challenge. You know, there are games that are already out for the Xbox that are going to work, you know, just fine on a new Xbox One X, but they were already released, and they don't have 4K.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those capabilities were not there when the game was designed, but there are people who are still going to want to play them, and they're going to want them to be improved. So game developers are tasked with, you know, kind of releasing updates that will improve the visual quality of the games that are available, but that costs you know, resources. You know, people mm-hmm. who are actually you know, redesigning those assets and making them higher quality. And so there are game developers. There's this kind of split right now between game developers who are offering this update for free, and game developers who are going to you know, want to charge for this update. And there's a lot of mixed reaction from consumers about, you know, what feels like basically paying for a game twice. Because, you know, the you know, you're getting it's still an Xbox, you're still able to play Xbox games, but the quality difference there is going to be noticeable. So it's going to be really interesting to see when the console comes out, you know, how people really react to paying maybe 10 or 15 bucks extra for the game that they've already bought in order to make sure that it plays nice on this new console.
Russell Holley, glad to hear you again. Thank you so much for all your time today.
It's been a pleasure.
That's Russell Holley. He is a contributing editor at Android Central. Thanks so much for listening. That's it for Tech Tuesday today on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.